So yesterday, as part of her introduction to her talk on faith, Nalitha quoted a Zen teacher by the name of Sherry Hubber, who said that she teaches Dharma talks to encourage people to practice. I think it's a wonderful idea. If I may borrow a little bit from that quote, that what I'd like to do today is a talk on effort. I would like, rather than to encourage you to practice, I'd like to evoke in you the courage to practice. Because sometimes as practice you need a lot of courage. Courage to do what? That'll be part of the discussion in the practice. And, you know, I think some of you know that the word courage comes from the French word heart. So it's a heart quality. In the English-speaking world, many people don't automatically think of courage as being heart quality. Heart quality is kindness and love and compassion. But I'd like in the course of the talk to also to connect courage to compassion. Both equally valuable and important qualities of the heart, of your hearts. So there are five faculties: faith, effort, energy, vitality, vigor, courage. Today I'd like to call it courageous effort. Then mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. And I call it courageous effort because the word in Sanskrit and Pali virya is related to the Indian, even the modern Indian word for soldier. Veer, so short of virya, is a soldier. Some Indian languages, and was translated in some Buddhism was translated in some languages, maybe in Tibetan, virya is called heroic effort, because it's not just like, you know, ordinary everyday kind of plain effort. You know, I had to tie my shoes, it took some effort. It you know, we're talking about something that's kind of special. And so courage, heroic effort, so courageous effort. And how to talk about courageous effort so that the effort is right effort. Healthy effort. Beneficial effort. Because I think not a few people, when they hear the word effort, especially if you add make in front of it, make effort, I don't think it inspires that many people. I think probably more people are dispirited when they hear those two words together than they are enthused. Make effort. It would be nice if by the end of the talk the expression make effort was met in you with enthusiasm. And the idea of being courageous is something that maybe you will feel like this is something you want to do. It's invaluable. And what does compassion have to do with all of it? So that's the introduction. And then we're tying the topic of the five faculties with impermanence. And one of the great quotes of the Zen teacher who founded the San Francisco Zen Center, named Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, he summarized Buddhism in three words. So some of you who don't want to do a lot of the reading, don't want to get a PhD in Buddhism, all you have to do is memorize these three words, and you're set. The three words are not always so. Not always so. things are not always going to be the way they are. It's not always this way. Things are always changing and are different, and you can count on that. It's not always going to be so. And why is that? Why would the Zen teacher say that's like all of Buddhism is encapsulated in those three words? There's something very significant about our meeting of change, our meeting impermanence, our meeting of inconstancy, and how things are always changing and moving. That is the heart of of our suffering, and the heart of what can liberate us from suffering. And this topic of change, of impermanence, of things passing, dying, of things becoming different than what they were. Some of us, maybe some of us, a few of us, might be aging, which is a change that's coming. And if you've not realized that you're not one of those people who's already starting to age, then you're one of those people who are still maturing. Which is a wonderful thing too. It's always change. Always we're growing and changing, and things are. It's built into who we are as human beings. Some of the change is celebratory. Some of it is liberating. Some of it is relieving. It brings relief. Some of it is horrific. Some of it is terrible, frightening. Some of it is oppressive and just a drag. It's the whole range. And some of it is just like, who cares? The whole range in between. And you can probably trace a lot of our suffering as human beings to some kind of change that happened to us. Some kind of change that we anticipate. Some kind of change we're going through right now. And so our relationship to change is at the heart of Buddhism. And this idea, not always so, is a wisdom statement that creates a context, a perspective for understanding all this world of change. And I think a fair amount of human suffering comes from not realizing that it's not always so. It's not always going to be so. Things do change. And so we're caught by surprise by it. It shouldn't be that way. The change happens too soon. All kinds of things. So this idea of learning how to be with change and finding a healthy way and finding our freedom in it is so valuable. There are some religious traditions where they don't find the freedom in change, with change. They find freedom by transcending change. They somehow go, the mind goes, the soul goes, to something which is beyond, above, transcendent to the world of change. Because perhaps they have no sense of it's possible to find freedom, love, compassion, peace, in this world of change, and so they look somewhere else. And that's a completely reasonable thing that people make that conclusion, because some people live lives where it seems they don't see any possibility of hope to get out of their misery, oppression, war, unless it's somehow in the next life or in some other place. And because people have horrific lives. And that's how they have hope. That's how they can get by or manage the next day. Buddhism, which is maybe a little bit of a religion for the people who are fortunate, for the people who have some possibility of addressing the change, have some ability to institute some kind of change in their life, so that they find their freedom in the midst of it all. And so we all have that fortune. The fact that you're here for this week is phenomenal. I don't take it lightly, given what happens in people in the world all around us. And I mean, this is a phenomenal opportunity. And so how do we find our way with change? And so I want to evoke as an example or reference point a story, an event that happened to me about five, six years ago. Am I loud enough? Okay. So 5-6 years ago I went down the Colorado River on a raft, a rubber raft, and with Susie Harrington, who Lalitha just finished a retreat with her, a nature retreat. So Susie Harrington is a Buddhist teacher, friend and colleague, who has spent much of her life outdoors. And she brings people into the outdoors, introduces them to practicing Dharma in the outdoors. So she invited me along to go down the Colorado River. It wasn't a retreat, it was just a group of friends going. But it was definitely kind of a retreat. It was 21 days. I'd never done anything like this. And it was a remarkable thing to do. And I would say that I was afraid the whole time. And I thought something was wrong with me. But when I told Susie that, my fear and how I lived with it, and she said, "Oh, you have to tell. You have to talk to everyone else now and help them, because I was okay with it." After a while, I thought, "This is actually healthy, in this circumstance, to have some degree of fear." So I called fear my companion, and I'll take that along with me. So I learned a lot about the river. And rivers, and rivers makes this wonderful metaphor. Rivers are always changing, not always so. And if we didn't know that, we'd be in trouble. At parts of the river, we had to wake up in the middle of the night, sometimes to move the boats, because the river levels was changing at night so much that we had to kind of take care of it. But one of the things we learned was, I learned because I didn't know how to do this before, was it mattered where in the river you had your raft. And you had to read the river, and to read it really well, to see, read the current, and find the current, and find the right current. And if you could find the right current, then it was relatively easy to go down the Grand Canyon. But if you got the wrong current, and one of the currents that's wrong are called eddies. I didn't know what an eddy was. Maybe some of you don't know. An eddy is where the current cycles around on itself and becomes like a little bit of a whirlpool, kind of cycling around and around. And if you get into an eddy, sometimes it's very hard to get out. And we had that experience. I got into one. And it took, I don't know how long it took, an hour to somehow get... You had to be row hard and strategically in just the right way. We kept trying, and it kept getting pushed back into this little whirlpool thing. It was quite something. But if you find the right current, then you can be taken down the Grand Canyon, at least to the next rapids, which has its own story. So it turns out that some of you know that the first level of awakening, first kind of jump in maturity in Dharma practice, is something called, usually called in English, stream enter. But the word that we translate as stream more literally means current. It's entering it's entering the current of the river. So the current can carry you along. And people who enter that kind of current of practice start feeling that now it's not so much that they are practicing, but they're being practiced by the Dharma. Something is practicing them rather than you're doing the practice all the time. So you're in the stream, you're in the current, something is carrying us along. But right nearby, sometimes right next to the main current, is the eddies. And don't just learn about the current. As Vipassana students, insight students, it's your job to become experts on the currents, on the eddies, and the rapids. What are they? They are the what's called the five hindrances. They're eddies because you get stuck in them. You fall into this eddy of one of the five, and it's sometimes really hard to get out. And sometimes we're in it, we don't even know we're in it. We just think like we're happily in the river, like we're doing the right thing. They're also the rapids, because if you go not careful how you go through the hindrances, they can, you know, tip your boat over. You can fall in the river. They have something called, what are they called in the river? Holes. I didn't know rivers had holes in them. So you had to look for the hole. You had to be sure you kind of avoided the holes in the rivers. And what it was where there was a small, like, rapid, like small drop in the river over some rocks. And as the water goes over the rocks, it kind of goes with great force, speed, but it pushes itself down below the surface of the water under that it lands into. And it goes down, and then it comes around. It's going down river a little bit, but it comes around, and it's like a vertical eddy. It comes down, then it cycles up again to the top. And the first time we fell in and got stuck in an eddy, we lost the rower temporarily. He fell in the water. And I didn't know anything about rowing. It was the first day on the river. And I thought we were just going up and down in the waves. Turns out we weren't going anywhere. We were just going around and around in this hole until the hole popped us out. So, and then the last rapids of the whole trip, 21 days, I did something you should never do. I lowered my guard, and I made a little mistake. And that's the rapids that I was thrown out of the boat. So that was kind of exciting. So these hindrances are like eddies and rapids. And you have to learn how to be with them. And it is possible. So this woman that Susie Harrington I went with, I called her, I was so in awe of her skills on the river. I called her a river whisperer. And she could read the river so well. And she made it look so easy. I mean, she would go down the most torrential, the most horrible, churning rapids. And there was one that I decided not to take. I walked around because I'm not going down that one. And she would make it look like it was like a little walk in the park. Like hardly, you know, she hardly had to do anything. Like, you know, you just push the paddle in here a little bit and, you know, because she knew exactly how to read the river. And so she was very skilled. So one of the remarkable memories of that trip was you'd be hovering above a rapid. And you're being pulled in, but you're kind of a little bit hovering there, not going in too quickly. And Susie Harrington would stand up in the raft. You know, it's hard, you know. She would stand up in the raft with tremendous calm and dignity and alertness, and just stand there and study the rapid. Look up and down, study it, see where the openings were, where to go. And then as if it was just like, you know, nothing or something, she would then just calmly sit down, point the raft in the right direction, and we kind of like went right through. Like it was nothing. Whereas the boats behind us flipped over and all kinds of things happened. So Susie Harrington stood facing the rapids with calm. She was calm. That was her courage. And the courage I would like to suggest that we need to have for this practice is the courage to stay calm. It's a little bit, juxtaposition of, we don't often associate those two together, do we? Courage and calm. I mean, courage is like go out and fight or do something great, right? But the courage to be calm in the middle of this changing life, the river of life. And why be courageous? So you can be a life whisperer. So you can stand and look and see and read the river of your life. Read the rapids, read the eddies, find the current. In a way that you can't if you're not calm. Being calm doesn't mean that there's no reasons to be agitated. It means in spite of all the reasons to be agitated, you have the courage to face them calmly. It's counterintuitive because no matter how big the dangers are, like we're alarmed, we're concerned, we have to do something, fight or flight, all this stuff that we end up doing. And it's so convincing that we have to give up our calm to take care of ourselves. We're not safe if we're calm, is the rationale for some people. I propose to you that we're actually safer, more often than not, if we're calm than if we're not. So what are we calm about? One of the things to become calm about, so we can stand there in our boat and really look at it and read it and see where the opening is, see what's going on, are these five hindrances. So these are, it's actually two words, different words that are used for the first hindrance. One of them is sensual desire. There's not a few people, humans, that have sensual desire. All kinds. And the other word is acquisitiveness, wanting things of other people or wanting something. And then there is ill will, hatred, hostility. Usually the next one is called sloth and torpor. One of the words doesn't mean sloth, it means rigidity. And so it's becoming rigid. I think of it as resistance and rigidity, going numb. When things are so difficult, we go numb. We freeze, get rigid. And resistance is a strategy of kind of shutting down. So it's not ordinary tiredness. And then there is restlessness and regrets. And then there's doubt. Doubt in the practice, doubt in our ability to do the practice, doubt in the teachings, doubts in the teachers, doubt about anything and everything we can have doubt about. And it's said that doubt is the most dangerous of the hindrances, primarily because doubt will cause people to stop practicing. The other four hindrances you can still try to practice. So each of these is like a little whirlpool that if you get into the edges of it, it's easy to fall into it and be swirling around. And I think of them sometimes as black holes. We fall in and the light never comes out because the awareness never comes out because we're so preoccupied with our fantasies of desire or desperations for wanting things better. And the wanting mind can be so strong and planning, fantasizing, wanting. Sometimes there's that desperation around sensual desire when it involves an addiction. And then there is ill will. Some people are addicted to ill will. Hostility, anger, complaining, looking for everything, blaming. And it's a huge universe to fall into. Eddie, maybe it's more like a the rapids, because it's so dangerous to be caught up in ill will. Some people value ill will and because they feel energized. They feel alive, there's vitality, and also some kind of self-righteousness that can be there if you're hostile and angry to someone else who's done something wrong. So it can be very convincing that you're justified to have hostility. So we get pulled into that eddy. And going numb is its own kind of eddy, its own kind of going rigid and freezing, or having kind of this resistance of just shutting down. It's just too overwhelming, it's too difficult, I can't handle it, it's too much for me. And like one of my strategies in life is the ostrich strategy. I think it belongs to the sloth and torpor camp. And I stick my head in the equivalent of the sand. There's no problem here. Nothing's going on. And it hasn't served me very well when I've done that. But that's kind of, we all have kind of probably our kind of go-to hindrance that we go to if we're challenged. And so that was one of my go-to hindrances. The other go-to one for me probably has been doubt. And then there is this restlessness, agitation, being a deer trapped in the headlights, not knowing what to do, but just running in circles anyway, and just kind of agitated. Or just being lost in this eddy of regret. Oh, what a terrible thing I did. I'm a terrible person because I did that. And just kind of berating ourselves and criticizing ourselves and kind of drowning in guilt. And then doubt, as I said, it's just... Doubt, the word doubt in Pali, it has more of a meaning probably than the English word doubt of indecisiveness. Not being able to make a decision on what to do. That's one of the functions of doubt as a hindrance, is to keep us from making a decision. A commitment avoidance sometimes, just because it's better, just doubt keeps us safe from the commitments we want to make. So these are eddies we fall into. One of the very important things to understand about these is that they are part and parcel of a normal human life. You're not like an aberration to humanity if you happen to have sensual desire, happen to have hostility. This is the common strategies that kind of were built, our whole psychophysical system is kind of built in to do this, partly because they're part of the protective mechanism. As dysfunctional as they can be, and as much suffering they can cause, deep down inside, they're part of the systems we have in place to keep us safe. And it's probably not working for that purpose, but you know, it's a good reason why we have these tendencies. So in this kind of practice we do, insight practice, we don't welcome the hindrances. But when they're there, we don't berate ourselves from having them. If they're there, the ideal kind of approach of in this practice is to stand up in your boat and look at them, study them before you fall in. Become an expert, become a whisperer of the hindrances. Really know how to see them, smell them, feel them, recognize their texture, the somatic experience of it, the emotional experience of it, the energetic experience of it, the mental experience of it, the cognitive beliefs that come along with it. Take your time. And you're encouraged when you're doing this practice, Vipassana practice, actually to take your time with the hindrances. Don't be in a hurry to get rid of them, to fix them. Just calmly look at them and study, get to know them. Have the courage to stay calm in the midst of it. And so in the process you might learn about the hindrances, become a hindrance whisperer. But maybe more important, what you learn is you learn something about staying calm. you're strengthening the calm muscle so you can look at the situation more carefully. And in the Buddhist orientation towards things, the most useful or most important orientation to have is to be able to discern the difference between what is beneficial for you and what is not beneficial, what is harmful and what is not harmful, what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. To be able to see that difference allows us to see the Dharma current and the eddies. There's always a Dharma current here. And the Dharma current is always found in that which, when we do nothing harmful for others or for ourselves. The Dharma current is found when we meet our experience with care and compassion to find the right way, rather than meeting it with hostility or greed or conceit or wishful thinking or all kinds of other things, rather than meeting it with the hindrances. And that takes some capacity to distinguish these two currents in the river of life. And this is a hugely important part of right effort. Right effort begins when we can see the difference between what's healthy and not healthy. Because then you can make the effort to put your boat in the healthy current. And maybe it just needs a little, if you're Susie Harrington, it just means just a little kind of teeny twisting of the paddle, almost like an afterthought, and you go right into the right place. If it's Gil Fronsdal, it means you have to row hard. You know where the current, you know where the good current is, but you have to kind of really, make some effort here. So now I want to talk more about compassion. And talking about compassion, I want to kind of, in a sense, step back and kind of take a different current of thought to get to the same place. What I want to do is to describe how through compassion the five faculties follow along. And you'll get a very different feel for what these faculties are if we begin with compassion. So maybe you've had the occasion to help a friend who maybe hurt themselves. Maybe they have a cut, maybe they have a thorn, maybe they scrape themselves pretty badly and there's a lot of gravel and dirt in their scrape. And they ask you to help to take the thorn out or to take out the gravel and the dirt and clean their wound, maybe put a little bit of antibiotics on it, maybe put a Band-Aid on it. Maybe it's not an adult friend, maybe it's a little child who doesn't understand what's happened to them. It'll happen on the school playground and they'll be okay, but it's a lot, it's a very tender little scrape and wound. And so the child is in good, is fine, it's going to be fine, and you're not alarmed. This is a school ground kind of scrape. But you also want to care for the child. So you don't start barking at the child, just crying, "Come with me, I'm going to clean that wound. How could you have gotten such a scrape?" If you're attuned to the child, if you want to care for the child who's upset, scared, hurt, you approach the child in a particular way, kindly, calmly, some kind of way. Because as a people whisperer, you can read how the person is. And you can read, you know the effect it's going to have, how you approach them. So you gently bring the kid to some place where you can maybe gently with some water and cotton maybe and start cleaning the wound. But each time you touch, it stings. But you care, you have compassion, you want to do this with the least amount of hurt, pain for the child as possible. So you stay calm, because that's how you really can be attuned to the child and really stay careful, attentive to that, how much pressure you put with the wet cotton or the cloth, and how much you kind of rub or not, or just tap, pat, you know. You're just really attuned, really there, careful, because you really don't want to cause any extra pain for a child. What's driving it is some kind of compassion for the child. The result of that kind of compassionate action, there's a lot of mindfulness. There's a lot of careful attentiveness to the moment, to how you're using your hands, how you're being with the child, your stance, your attitude, how you sit with the child, how you gently bring the cloth or the cotton to the wound, and how you gently tap, and how you pour water over it. And there's so much care in all these little details. There's a lot of mindfulness. And no one ever told you to be mindful. You didn't even once think that, okay, this is the chance I have to practice my mindfulness. I've been doing this mindfulness for years. Okay, now I'm going to really buff it up. I'm going to really going to do it well. I'll show them this is how mindfulness is done. If you're really there with this child, it probably doesn't occur to you to practice mindfulness. But mindfulness is there, completely there. As you're doing this with a child, you're discerning very carefully how much pressure you touch the wound with. So you know the difference between what's painful and not painful. What kind of, you don't want to scrape it so much, that you actually dig up the wound even more. You just do it very tenderly, very lightly, just ever so slight. Maybe there's even one little piece of gravel deep inside it. You get a Q-tip to be able to keep, maybe a wet Q-tip, can you maybe pull it out, or little tweezers, and you're so careful and discerning what's going to hurt and what's not going to hurt for the child. What's helpful and not helpful. No one's telling you to have right effort. No one's telling you what kind of effort to make. You kind of intuitively know the kind of gentle, careful kind of, but you're making a lot of effort that you're staying calm because you're helping the child stay calm. A lot of effort to do it just the right way, and you're just very discerning. You're really seeing clearly the distinction between what causes more harm and less, more hurt. And you're practicing right effort. No one told you to practice right effort. You didn't have to even learn about Buddhism and right effort. It just follows in the wake of being compassionate. There's probably a lot of something that you trust, something you have faith in, something that you have confidence in. You have faith and trust in the manner in which you take care of the child. You have faith and trust and confidence that it's worthwhile spending time with a kid and being present. You have confidence in the compassion. But no one ever told you to have faith or confidence. You're just being compassionate. But right there in the compassion, there's something you have a lot of faith in. And is there samadhi? Is there concentration? I bet for a few moments, if you could just have the concentration you have for that minute where you're caring for that wound here at this retreat all day, this retreat would be phenomenal for you. You would be so, by the end of the day, and you'd just be completely bright and clear and peaceful and nice. But because you're so much compassion and care for the child, you're zeroed in on the wound, on the child, you're no longer thinking about your problems at home, you're not thinking about, you know, this wonderful event that you're going to the next day, or the wonderful event you have to give up because you're here with a child. You're just there, fully there in the moment with the child. Samadhi. The samadhi of compassion. And wisdom. The wisdom is, is the really knowing and recognizing what's harmful and not harmful, but knowing all the different ways of adjusting and being and understanding yourself so you can be an effective, compassionate person. You see the hindrances arise. And, you find it really difficult to see this terrible wound and there's an aversion to it. Oh, I know this. I'm an aversion whisperer. I know what that's about. And I know, I have wisdom about that. I know not to give in to it. This is not the time. Let's go back to care for the child. So I give this lengthy example because I would like to try to convey the idea that the very things we're cultivating here, the five faculties, especially mindfulness, it doesn't have to be something that we're always doing. It's something that we set up the conditions to allow it to operate, to move through us. And one of the things that allows all these to work through us and to grow and develop is compassion. And when we talk about make effort, it's making effort that flows from compassion. If you're caring for the child, make effort to care for it. But no one needs to tell you that. That's just second nature that you do that. So how is it that sitting here on the retreat can be an act of compassion for yourself, for others here, for the world? We suffer, human beings. We suffer terribly. Life is really hard. And we have hearts that can meet it, the suffering of the world, with the hindrances. And we have hearts that can meet it with compassion and care, kindness. What's the difference between meeting it with the hindrances versus meeting it with care and compassion? It's a difference between making more suffering and alleviating suffering. Right there, we start seeing where right effort is. Well, the right effort is in the compassion current. The right effort, right, the current of the Dharma current is found through caring, valuing. But compassion is not easy to have, to discover, but it's a wonderful ideal. How do you have compassion? You have compassion if you can stand in your boat calmly and gaze onto the rapids, to look at the suffering. It's through being calm that we have a chance to tap into this deep place inside. Not the protective place, not the place that always wants to protect us, that sometimes an overdrive, protecting us at times when we don't really need protection. But a deeper place inside, the place that of nurturing, the capacity we have to nurture and to give birth to beautiful qualities. And so the calmness lets us tap into deep, deep reservoirs of wisdom, of mindfulness, of faith, of samadhi. These reservoirs, these pools inside of us that are waiting to be born from our depths. it's eventually less about what we do and more about what we allow and nurture and support and recognize. To recognize mindfulness and then allow it to continue. To recognize making effort, good effort, the effort to be in the current of what's healthy and hope. To recognize and then allow for it, make room for it. To recognize faith, to recognize what we have trust in that's healthy and good for us, and allow it to blossom and grow. So you might, if you have the courage to be calm, no matter what happens, including, you know, kind of an odd turning of things, when you're not calm, can you find how to be calm in the middle of the storm? Can you find how to see, use your ability to be mindful, to be aware? And can you find the calm in the awareness of being agitated? Things not always so. Things are always changing. Storms are coming. Rapids are coming. Challenges are coming. But what is it like to discover that you can calmly be aware of it? Awareness doesn't change necessarily the circumstance you're in. But awareness makes it possible to have compassion and care. To find the calm in the mindfulness of, in the mindfulness itself. And here also, so this, as we're discerning what's the currents we're following, it's possible to feel how it is like to be mindful. And I've been mindful at times in ways that gave me a headache. I was straining, wanting something to happen, trying to make something happen, bearing down, you know, like I got to do this right, you know. And I've learned after a good amount of time of doing this stuff to recognize that when it's happening. That is not productive, not useful. That's the wrong current to be in. What's the right mindfulness current to be in? It's one that's not those things. It's one that has some modicum of calm or clarity, lack of expectation, lack of desperation, lack of trying to prove something or attain something. It's a radical simplicity, a radical simple just knowing. Oh, it's like this. Ah. The protective forces inside of us might argue with, you can't do that. You have to be alarmed. You have to be angry. You have to run around. But the courage to choose the healthy current, that's right effort. That's what we have effort for, courageous effort for. The courageous effort to choose the place that is where we don't, not harming ourselves more. To be self-critical and blame ourselves is harming ourselves. To assign blame to everybody else and be angry with how everyone else is not cooperating with the program is also harming ourselves. And as we get more mindful, we become more acutely sensitive to how we're practicing, how we're meeting the world, how we're relating to everything. And that, and how we relate, how we're mindful, how we're with things, that's where we find the Dharma current. That's where we find the ability to choose to the effort that feels good for us, that nourishes us, nurtures us, supports us, guides us, opens us, frees us. And for that to happen, at times it takes a lot of courage. It goes against the current of popular life and what we've learned and what we think is important and the strategies we've been told that are what we have to do. It takes some courage to do this practice. But it's not a courage that's going to cause strain. It's not a courage to be, you know, to put on your armor and buckle down and work hard. It's a courage. It is a courage to work hard. It's a courage to work hard at not working hard. It's a courage to work hard at being relaxed. Being open, being present, being calm. And I can say that because that's self-protective. To work hard, diligent, committed, continuous at being calm means you can't work hard in a non-calm way. It's being diligent, it's being continuous, being committed, it's being yes in a good way, in a yes in an enthusiastic way, yes. I want to have this kind of courage, the kind of courage that helps me find peace in every moment, in every breath. So right effort has a lot to do with how we make effort. And so to be able to discern a how that's in the Dharma stream and a how that's in the hindrance stream makes all the difference in the world to see that. So I hope this talk has given you some courage. If it hasn't, I hope it's at least encouraged you. If it hasn't, then I hope it has given you something to support you as you look more and more deeply and how you're practicing and what this practice is about. And maybe you can experiment with having more compassion for yourself, for others, as you do this mindfulness practice. And see that in the compassion, in fact, mindfulness follows without you having to do the mindfulness. Wouldn't that be nice? So thank you very much.